Hello and welcome to the AV Forums podcast for Monday, the 24th of April. And joining me on this edition, our assistant editor, Steve Withers.
I got the pool, she got the pool man.
And audio reviewer, Ed Selly.
How many drivers does a buggy have?
A lot happens since the last podcast. It was Easter weekend, which fantastic Easter weekend. Did you guys have a good Easter?
Very pleasant, thank you, yes.
Not bad, actually, yes. The lovely weather, lovely was... Hang on, let me do that again. The weather was lovely. Yeah, the weather was lovely. I don't think it was forecast to be that nice, but it was gorgeous down south.
It was just as nice up north. Well, I say that Easter Sunday was a bit of a washout, but yeah, you can't have everything. Saturday was reasonable. And Friday I got out in Big Blue and quickly went through 60 quid in fuel. Like I say, a lot happens in 7 or 8 days because we actually recorded it early. We're having a general election on the 8th of June.
Yeah.
We didn't see this one coming, did we? And I mean, really, how can she lose? Because nobody in their right mind is going to vote Labour. And I couldn't even tell you who any of the Lib Dems are, never mind the leader. So it's going to be a wasted vote, really, isn't it?
Well, we'll have to see. It's fair to say that the omens for people who are ardent supporters of either the Labour Party or the Liberal Democrats doesn't look great. But equally, there's enough information written by grown-ups that suggests that some of the polling that we do in the UK is actually fatally flawed. I mean, whether it's fatally flawed that it's 24 points out is a subtly different
margin of error there. I mean, 1% maybe, but, you know.
Yeah, it's not ideal. But no, for people of an internet comedic persuasion, the internet has already wound up into overdrive about this. There was a photo of the Black Knight from the Holy Grail, minus arms and legs, going, you know, vote Jeremy Corbyn, and so forth. So yeah, I mean, you know, obviously. I think the key thing to sort of take into account is exactly the same things we were saying during the Trump phase. If you're not of a conservative disposition, and you know, large stretches of the UK are not, the way that modern democracy is set up is that fundamentally it's not. There's still a fair amount of checks and balances, and also when you actually look at the spread of political opinion in the UK, you are actually arguing over a portion of the centre. I mean, we don't have even Jeremy, when he's having, you know, when he's had something very potent and vegetarian to eat, isn't actually that mad. So, you know, take it from
actually,
there.
I went through a whole load of his policies, and a lot of them are quite reasonable, actually.
This is the thing. Unfortunately, the problem is you then have to look at the actual voting history of the men, because it's Corbyn and John McDonnell. But essentially, their voting history and some of their utterances, both in public and off the record, are absolutely deranged at times. What was it, John McDonnell, at one point, not that long ago, was calling for 100% tax over incomes of £100,000, so, which I believe actually stops being a tax and actually just becomes seizure. But, you know, just semantics.
You see, I don't think Corbyn's mad or anything like that. And like Steve says, you know, some of the policies, you look at them and you think, yeah, okay, that seems fair. It's just the guy is a dullard. He's not charismatic. He has no leadership skill. He doesn't come across to me as someone who, given a stressful situation where he has to make a sudden decision, whether right or wrong, is going to make it. He seems like somebody who's going to bumble around. Whereas Theresa May, love her or hate her, at least she'll give you a decision whether it's right or wrong. She'll make a decision. I think she's actually proven herself to be a good leader, whether you like her or not. She's proven that she has that skill.
Yeah, my problem with Theresa May is, and I'm actually nicking this joke from Jonathan Pye, but she looks like the Emperor from Star Wars in Grayson Perry's wig, doesn't she? I mean, she's there's something unsettling about that woman.
To be honest, the nature of people's appearance, there's not a huge amount we can do about that. I mean, I have some reservations. Essentially, she is there's elements of Gordon Brown. She's a control freak. She doesn't like delegating. And whilst it's admirable to try and deal with the modern media on your own terms, unfortunately, the modern media doesn't necessarily work that way. I mean, for example, it's completely logical that she doesn't want to do a televised debate. She has precisely nothing to gain from it. Nothing whatsoever. But there's an element of control freakery, which, yeah, we're about to do some fairly important negotiations. There are some considerations there, but you know.
Well, you see, I think the whole debate thing's flawed anyway. It's just about soundbite debates, which to me doesn't seem like a valuable way of finding out about policies and all the rest of it.
Now, if we did it as political leadership contestant gladiator, or maybe even just 15-1, that could be quite good.
My money would definitely be on Theresa May in that case. I mean, Corbyn's a pacifist; he's got no chance in some gladiatorial combat, has he?
What, being hit by a big pugil stick?
Nicola Sturgeon probably be quite handy in that sort of thing too.
I think Nicola Sturgeon and Theresa May in the final to the death. That'd be interesting.
Actually, I'd pay to watch that.
Right, enough election time. There's actually a new bot out there on Twitter. It's twitter.com/DannyDyerBot. Give us some lines, Ed.
Right, Danny Dyer bot is the produce of a bot making sort of organisation. He's a bit hit and miss. I'm assigning it the gender he because I believe fundamentally it's male. So my computer's just decided that it's going to call it a day at this point. Right, so this morning, for example, I'm Danny Dyer and I'm about to meet Britain's sauciest astronauts. That works quite nicely, but they're not all as good.
We have to explain that this is from Danny Dyer's documentary days, not his EastEnders days.
Whereas I'm Danny Dyer and I'm about to meet Britain's mightiest florists. Quite enjoyed that. Britain's most poetic beekeepers.
I like Britain's best dressed porn stars.
Britain's most ridiculous barman. I'd probably actually watch that.
We're having a laugh at this, but actually his documentary, see, I'm trying to remember, I think it was Men and Motors, wasn't it? Or it was Bravo or something like that it used to run on. And he used to go out and meet the hard men or football hooligans and that kind of thing. But it was so much a parody of itself. It was unbelievable.
Britain's unworthiest seagulls.
Britain's hairiest robots.
My favourite has been Britain's most spherical geese. I mean, these things are all just one joke punchlines. But
I've got to throw in with Britain's most unlikely cattle rustlers.
Britain's clumsiest beekeepers. Actually, again, I'd watch that. Britain's smelliest Tories. And the thing about all these bots on Twitter is that it's a one-note joke. Sometimes it's funny for a while. I mean, there is one, and I have to say I follow this one, and it's a slightly different take on it because you follow it and it then follows you back. It's called Appropriate Tributes. And periodically, it will just reply with a tribute to whatever you've just tweeted. And it just uses an algorithm to look at the words that's most likely to be a noun and then just sort of throw it together from there. So after I retweeted Britain's sauciest astronauts, it lurched into life and... hold on a second, where's it gone? So it'll just sort of yell... it's been given a series of things to talk about. You know, bombshells unto the bombshell god. Essentially it'll just look at a word that you've done, and depending on what you've just tweeted, it can just normally if I retweet for example a review that's gone up on AV forums, it'll then, because it doesn't fully understand what in an electronics review is a noun and what isn't, the results are usually just surrealistically brilliant. So it's worth a look if nothing else.
I remember during the last election, which I can't believe was only 2 years ago, you mentioned, Ed, that there was, I suppose it was either somebody being very quick off the mark or some kind of algorithm on Twitter, but whenever David Cameron posted a tweet, it immediately came back with off dish face.
Yeah.
And then whenever Ed Miliband made a tweet, it immediately came back with off beaker. I really hope they do that again this year.
To be fair, any time Jeremy Corbyn posts, it's normally just off Steptoe.
Yeah, so and off Palpatine, can't we? No,
Twitter is utterly, utterly flawed. I mean, how they ever expect it to be a properly profitable business model is entirely unclear. But it's the direct interface between you know, celebrities slash people of note and people of no note that makes it absolutely fabulous in that regard. I mean, don't get me wrong, some people come in for thoroughly unreasonable abuse, but I'm afraid my views as towards politicians, people who have gone out of their way to be in the public eye, whilst they should never be subject to racist or, you know, really unpleasant abuse, but fundamentally, David Cameron has a face like a dish. I think it's a completely reasonable thing to point out off dish face.
And the band is a spitting image of Beaker, so there's no question about that.
Yeah.
And, I mean, look at that. That was 2 years ago, and look how quickly things change, eh?
Yes. Yes, Ed Miliband looks quite solid now, doesn't he, Pike?
He was on the last leg last week. And I thought, if it had only been that interesting in the election campaign, he might have done a lot better. Because he's become quite funny on Twitter. He's actually been bringing out some really decent gags of late. So
there was actually quite a poignant tweet about that. Because, you know, someone had pointed out, you know, all the hopes I had on election night 2015. If you'd beamed me that back through time, I'd have just burst into tears. It's like, oh, yes, you know, it's a funny old business. But no, we'll see where it goes. I mean, all I would say is, of course, I've now got my gout medication on the go. So I'm all ready for an all-night election night binge. However general elections wind out, I always enjoy watching them unfold in real time. It is the one night of the electoral cycle where you will find politicians answering questions with yes and no.
The first counts usually come in from up here, isn't it? It's normally,
yes,
Sunderland.
Sunderland.
Yeah. So watch that very carefully, because you know, when it came to the referendum, that kind of pointed the way, really.
Mm. Well, there was a throwaway tweet this morning from someone not a million miles away from you, Phil, in Durham, going, I've just canvassed the home of an ex-miner and lifelong Labour supporter who's just asked for a Conservative poster. Because, brackets, this doesn't normally happen. It's like, oh, thanks for explaining that to me.
You say that, right? And it just so happened that the news was on in the background yesterday and they were interviewing people. I think it was Bolton or some of this that's absolutely Labour solid. And everybody they spoke to said, had enough of Labour, I'm going Conservative this time. I couldn't believe what I was hearing.
They're going to regret that in 5 years.
Well,
they've got no schools, no health service, and their benefits are all gone.
Yeah, Steve, but what are you going to do? There's like, she's got it in the bag unless she absolutely seriously makes a huge cock up or something drastically goes wrong. She's in with a landslide of at least 100 to 140.
Yeah, which is really the worst thing imaginable, because you did need some sort of checks and balances, as Ed said. So yes, I can understand her point of view, which is I'm going to get a landslide and I can just shove through Brexit whichever way I want. But I actually want Parliament to debate it. To say, oh, I don't want anyone getting in the way of our Brexit plans, that's not democracy at all.
I think it's dictatorship.
Right, we're widely off tangent and we really need to reel this one back in. Thankfully, we've got lots to talk about in terms of AV, so do stick with us.
And if you haven't already, turn it off in absolute disgust.
Right, current competitions and previous competition winners. There are none at the moment. We don't have any competitions running. That will be fixed by next week, I am sure. It just so happens that the podcast is falling when two competitions are closing and we haven't got any going up as we record this. So, but keep an eye on the website. There will be competitions. So let's move on to hardware news. Samsung and Amazon are launching HDR10 with dynamic metadata. Now, this was something that we saw at CES, Steve. It was rather a throwaway, hidden in the corner concept that they didn't really cover in any great detail, and maybe because it wasn't quite finished at the time. But this is something that Samsung have added to HDR10, because obviously HDR10 is open source and available to everybody, and everybody can use their own versions of it. So they've developed this software where they can add dynamic metadata to anything that goes through the grading suite.
Yeah, absolutely. Basically, when we say dynamic metadata, what we're talking about is when you look at current HDR10 content, that uses static metadata. So basically, it's got a black level, a peak white level, say it's 1,000 nits, 4,000 nits, depending on how it was graded. And that's it for all the content. So that it's set from the beginning to the end of the film, and it's the same throughout the entire film. Now, obviously, any film, it changes from scene to scene. So the idea behind dynamic metadata is that it adjusts the peak brightness depending on the scene. So it will change from a scene to scene basis. It can even change from a frame to frame basis, necessarily, which would usually be the case between scene changes. And the idea is that it's better for displays that can't map the entire. So if a display does, for example, 1,500 nits, then clearly anything graded at 1,000 nits, it can display as it was graded. If it was graded at 4,000 nits, then it has to tone map it because it doesn't go up to 4,000 nits, and no domestic television does yet. So the idea is with dynamic metadata is it improves that tone mapping. It makes it better for all displays, but particularly less capable displays. And as you say, Phil, Samsung have been demonstrating this now. They started last year, and we saw a pretty much a finished version at CES. At the time, they were calling it HDR 10 Plus, and then they're saying they're thinking of coming up with a new name for it, but they've obviously decided to stick with HDR 10 Plus. The big issue is, with any of these things, is because it's obviously being driven by Samsung, is who's going to support it other than Samsung? And obviously the big news is not only that they've launched their, not only they launched their version of HDR 10 with dynamic metadata, but Amazon Video are also going to be using it globally, they said in their press release. They've been using it around the whole world. So that's interesting because it means, first of all, you've got a content provider actually using it. But the question now is whether any other TV manufacturers or display manufacturers will take it on board. Because something like dynamic metadata will be really, really good for projectors, because it would help a projector deal with different scenes. Because at the moment, I mean, if a film is, you know, has one set peak brightness for the entire film, and obviously it changes from scene to scene. I mean, things like Arrival, for example, absolutely crucify a projector. So that would be a really interesting feature to add to projectors. Now, the question is whether anyone's going to come on board with Samsung, whether any more content providers are going to come on board with Samsung. I know they are talking to various studios. It remains to be seen. Now, I should point out that Dolby Vision has always included dynamic metadata. That's been part of it from the start, and it does use dynamic metadata already.
And the important thing here to stress is that there have been lots of films already gone through the grading process in Dolby Vision.
Yes. And obviously Netflix use it already, as does Amazon in the States at least. And of course we had recently announced the first Dolby Vision Ultra HD Blu-rays, which is Despicable Me and Despicable Me 2. I should point out that HDR 10 Plus is not part currently of the Ultra HD Blu-ray specs. So there's a lot of, you know, it's interesting that it's happening. You know, I guess it's exciting, but it is obviously dependent on other people getting involved, and it is going to make it more confusing for the consumer, who is probably already pretty confused when it comes to the whole subject of HDR 10. One interesting point is, Samsung are upgrading their 2017 TVs will do HDR 10 Plus out of the box. They're upgrading their 2016 TVs. Obviously, it doesn't require HDMI 2.1. As we said in previous podcasts, certain aspects of the HDMI 2.1 standard can be delivered using HDMI 2.0 as long as the manufacturer included enough headroom originally to do that. And it would appear that obviously Samsung have been planning this for some time, and we're doing that on the 2016 TVs, and obviously are doing it on the 2017 TVs as well.
Okay, so it'll be interesting to see what happens with that. If I was a betting man at this moment in time, I'd say that's probably as much as we're going to hear about HDR 10 Plus with Amazon. I think that's as far as it'll go.
Yeah, probably. I mean, because if you look at it in terms of Dolby Vision, you've already got Sony and LG are backing that. Obviously, Samsung aren't going to, which leaves Panasonic currently the one that could go either way. But Dolby Vision is being supported by Netflix, as I say. It is being supported by Amazon in the US, and it's starting to roll out onto Ultra HD Blu-ray. So it's got a foothold that HDR 10 just doesn't have. And given it's not part of the Blu-ray specs, the 4K Blu-ray specs, adding it would be complicated and difficult. I just can't see studios. They'll go for the easiest option.
Once again, it's Samsung doing their own thing.
Come the sort of Sony of the 21st century, haven't they, really, doing their
only
own thing.
Only without the market share to actually make it stick. They do have a substantial market share, but it's just not enough to actually start dictating formats to the other organisations, in my humble opinion, anyway.
Yeah, I think as a consumer, you'd always want them to all get together, agree a single standard and stick with it from the beginning, but of course that never really happened, with one notable exception of DVD. To a certain extent, I always feel that with LG and Samsung, that they have to do the opposite of what the other one's doing. So if LG's in bed with Dolby Vision, there's no way Samsung are going to do that. They have to go and do their own thing instead. And, you know, you end up with the two biggest manufacturers always at loggerheads, which I don't think is necessarily always good for the consumer at the end of the day.
I wouldn't disagree with that.
Okay. So the next thing on the running order, it says historical curio or living legend, Ed. No, no, sorry, it's the Lynn turntable. It's not you that it's talking about as being a historical curio and living legend. It's
well, I'm a historical curio. I'm certainly not a living legend. Not yet, anyway.
So tell us about the Lynn then.
Yeah, well, this is an interesting one because, you know, obviously at the moment we are dealing with an unbelievable rate of technical change in AV. You know, we have people justifiably holding off from choosing a television because there's no question, there's no absolute certainty it will do everything it needs to do in about 2 years' time. So to offer, if you like, a redress to that, I have just finished reviewing a turntable which, as near as makes no difference, has been in production, continuous production, I stress, for 45 years. And that's the Lynn LP12. Mainly to... A, I suppose, give us a little respite from this constant technical change, but also just to ask the perfectly logical question, can something that was designed that long ago still actually possibly be a relevant choice for someone shopping for a turntable in 2017? And I was a bit surprised by the answer because I thought it would be pretty good. I envisaged myself going, you know, it does some lovely things and it's nicely made. But I thoroughly, thoroughly enjoyed listening to it. Really, really did. And the more time I spent with it in so many ways, the more sort of sense it made. You know, a lot of the most of the turntables I've reviewed for AV Forums are at the relatively sensible end of things, and they are relatively, you know, they're fairly self-contained and logical devices, but that's not always the case. I mean, the further up the price point you go, that they get larger and more sort of skeletal with, you know, bits flying in all directions. The Lynn looks like a record player. In fact, it looks like what many people perceive a record player to look like because it's been in production for so long. And, you know, it's self-contained. It is absolute simplicity itself to use and live with. It's not simplicity itself to set up. We've alluded to this previously, but it turned up. I realized I had not the faintest chance of getting it together properly, so went to consult an expert for that. But on the understanding that if you buy a new LP12, that comes as part of what the dealer will be offering, it's not a curio. It is a genuinely, genuinely enjoyable piece of equipment, and it's not cheap. There's no getting around that. This is the basic model that we've reviewed here, the Magic, and you still get the moment that you specify a lid, which I would recommend, it costs over £3,000. But you know, it's an exceptional piece of equipment. It also has an upgrade path like no other product you've ever seen. You can take any LP12 ever made and fit any of the current parts to it. And that means you could turn one that you found in a charity shop or whatever. I mean, they don't crop up there very often, I'll grant you, and turn it into the latest spec Acura LP, sorry, Climax LP12, getting on for £20,000. I mean, you know, we're getting all excited about Yamaha offering a software update for last year's AV receivers, but it kind of puts that into perspective.
£3,000 for a record player.
Sorry, how much is the additional cost of having a plastic top to it?
I believe that might be in the region of £200. Possibly
get out of town.
Hang on a second.
Right now, I'm just flashing back to that sketch from Not 9 O'Clock News, and I'm just roaring with laughter in the background. Yeah. You put a bag on your head as well, do you then, Ed?
I'm perfect. No, I'm lying. It's a hunt. Right. There are two lids, obviously. One is 120 and one is 150. And if you are feeling retro, there's a company that makes the smoked lids for the proper 1970s look as well, if you wanted such a thing. But the thing is that it's very important to get across £3,000. It's a lot of money. I make no bones about that at all. But we have been conditioned to think about our electronics having a life cycle as dictated by our televisions, our computers, our phones. If you spend £3,000 on an LP12, you know, essentially, provided it receives semi-regular, you know, care and attention, you don't, you know, store it on its side and you look at the bearing oil every 2 years or whatever, it doesn't wear it, you know, there's nothing that needs to be changed. You've bought it, you have a product for life. And basically, given it's already been in production for 45 years, I feel more confident saying you have a product for life about this than pretty much anything else I've ever reviewed.
Oh dear, that's Lingo and Bust next week.
we shall see. But but no, I thoroughly enjoyed it. I just would invite you to read the review and see where we go. It's just one of those things where there are, of course, alternatives. There are more spectacular alternatives. It's just one of those things where if you buy it, you kind of know that you're sorted. I mean, well, let's face it, even if Lin did go under, there are companies that make so much of bits, you know, alternative components for it, that probably wouldn't matter. You could probably keep using the other company's bits and bobs on it. It's you know, as I say, it would be a piece in itself, the number of different things you can do to an LP12.
Ed, you more and more strike me as someone who, if you had the budget, you'd be driving a 1979 Cortina.
Well, no, that can't be easily upgraded, can it? But equally,
it's a Ford. You can still buy the parts.
Yeah, but the thing is, that's not an exact allegory. It's more that would be more in keeping with what you can do with the LP12. Is more in keeping with the sort of work that, if you like, Eagle do to E-types, or you know, various companies do to air cooled 911s. Except that it's still the same company that does it. It's essentially the company.
You know. I mentioned cars, didn't I? Should
you? Yeah, you got it going now.
It's just one of those things. I personally think it's quite admirable. Let's face it. If you can point me in the direction of another product that we've reviewed recently, either myself or any of you guys, that has the potential to be a completely valid part of any system that you happen to own for anything like as long as that can, I'll consider it on its own merits.
I've got to say, Ed, I'm all for progress. I don't know about you, Steve, but I quite like the fact that, you know, we keep pushing technology and keep pushing technology and you know, look at stuff that's come and gone already, like the iPod and the original iPhone and stuff like that. You know what I mean? It's like, if we just stuck around with the same things, it'd be pretty boring. I know what you're saying,
Ed. We'd be out of a job because nothing to talk about.
Exactly.
the rate that we're releasing turntables, that's not going to be an issue.
But I agree what you're saying there, Ed. You know, there is things for products like that. And of course, Scottish engineering, you know, you can't go wrong with it, really.
No. No,
it does look very old-fashioned, though, I have to say, as a design.
It's weird because after I've had so many, for you guys and other people, I've had so many modernist sort of skeletal turntables go through. There's a pic on my Twitter feed from a couple of days ago because I've got an Italian turntable here and next to it one from a British company, Roxanne, and they're both sort of big bits of perspex with, you know, spectacular appendages and protuberances, and next to that the LP12 is just a piece of furniture, and in some ways I quite like that, but I do get where you're coming from. So if you want a bit more visual flourish, it might not be the product for you.
Was it Lin who made an LP12 out of whiskey barrels?
Yes, they did. Well, they made the plinth out of whiskey barrels. I think the arm would have been a challenge.
Yeah, not the whole thing.
Yes, they did. But if that's a bit sort of old school for you, there's an aftermarket company that has they started making different top plates for the LP12, and they thought, well, hang on a second, the success of this depends on the connection between the top plate and the plinth. So what if we machined out of a solid billet a plinth and a top plate? So basically you can transplant the guts of your LP12 into just this massive metal block. It's possibly the most metal turntable going.
So metal you can't lift it up.
it's really rather heavy. If you're worried about your children knocking something off, that's possibly something to look at. It's about 16 kilos of plinth.
Okay, so going from something that was designed in and first manufactured in 1972, wasn't it, Ed?
I've had to modify the copy because this is very complicated. Lin got going in 1973. So they want to say that next year is the 45th anniversary. It's not quite as simple as that because Sondek LP12s that weren't branded as Lin were released earlier than that. And I wanted to go to that timetable, but they are at pains to stress that Lin got going in 1973. So at the moment, it's the Lin LP12 is 44 and a bit years old. The design is 45.
It's a year older than me.
Yeah.
Okay, so going from something that, that is a year older than me to something that is absolutely brand spanking new and that everybody will be clambering to find out more about, and that is Sony's A1 OLED TV, Steve.
Yeah, the A1. Now, let's start with the obvious thing. As a piece of industrial design, the A1 is absolutely stunning. Obviously, we talked about it previously because we saw it at CES. And for those that don't know, it uses an acoustical surface. In other words, it uses the entire screen as a speaker, basically. So when you look at the A1 from the front, all you can see is the screen. That's it. There's nothing else. It's just a screen, tiny little light at the bottom, which you can turn off, and a tiny little Sony logo right in the top bottom left-hand corner. That's it. Just screen. And from that perspective, it's impressive. You think, blimey, that's amazing. However, I've got to say that this is definitely an example of form over function, because the problem is, first of all, the way it stands, there's a kind of a section at the back that you can fold out and lock into place, a bit like an old kid's blackboard. And that supports, and then there's a sort of a really heavy piece that you slot this back section into and connect it to the front, so it basically creates a stand. And when you do all that, the problem is, it's an absolute bugger to pick up, move, or do anything with. You can't reach the connections very easily because the screen is always in the way. So unless you've got, and I'm obviously have short arms, because I find it a real struggle to get around the screen and around the back of the TV to actually plug anything into the connections, which are at the back facing downwards at the back of the this rear section. And trying to move it around yesterday to photograph the connections, You hold the screen, but then you have to have long arms to reach this back. Honestly, it's a nightmare. And it's not something you think about when you literally look and think, that looks cool. But I tell you, getting it set up was a real pig. And obviously, one of the things that's going to be very divisive is that because of this stand, the screen is at a slight incline. And not dissimilar to last year's DX902, in fact. Now, Sony will say, oh, well, that's to give it the optimal viewing angle from when you're sat down. Now, first of all, that only applies if the TV's lower than you are, which I think in most people's cases is not the case. But also, it's an OLED, so viewing angles aren't an issue anyway. Obviously, the reason why it's at an incline is so it doesn't topple forward. So that's another thing that people are going to be annoyed by. Now, you can wall mount it. There's a rear section on the back of this sort of this rear section. You take a panel off, and you'll find Visa mounts there, and you can lock it in next to the screen and then attach it to a wall mount. Personally, if I owned it, I think I'd buy one of those Visa stands and attach it to that, because as it currently is, I just find it really annoying. So, yes, it looks stunning, but I think in practical terms, it can be a little bit fiddly and awkward. The acoustical surface, though, you're obviously paying for this, because, I mean, you're talking about £3,300 for the 55-inch version and £5,000 for the 65-inch version, which is the one I've got. And obviously, that massive 65-inch screen is part of the problem why you can't reach anything at the back. But it uses this acoustical surface. There are actuators on the rear of the panel that literally vibrate the screen and treat it like a giant speaker. Now, they only vibrate it a tiny amount because it's such a large surface area. And I have to say, I've never seen it vibrating. I've looked, I've turned out really loud. You can't see it in action. You can feel it though if you put your hand on the screen. And then in this rear section at the back, the bit that basically creates the stand, there's a subwoofer built to that. And it sounds great. It does sound really good. Now, the question obviously is, you're buying a £5,000 TV, do you actually care about the sound of the TV itself? Because you are definitely paying for that. But it does sound really good. So design-wise, it looks cool. It's a bit awkward in terms of practicalities. I think the use of the acoustic surface is inspired. It certainly makes it stand out from the rest of the... And this is going to be a busy, competitive year for OLED, because you've got four different manufacturers out there now with OLED TVs. But the big question is, does it look good? And yes, it looks absolutely stunning. I mean, interestingly, in terms of peak brightness, it's no different from last year. I measured it at 660 nits of peak brightness in the Cinema Pro mode, which is the accurate mode. So that's kind of par with last year's LGs. So anyone expecting it to be massively brighter or near 1,000 nits is going to be disappointed in that respect. But in terms of its performance, particularly just above black, I think it definitely looked better than last year's LGs. I think it delivered a really accurate picture. Again, it's a Sony TV, so you've got a 10-point and a 2-point white balance control, no CMS. The color accuracy was good. It could have been slightly better. It wasn't as good as, say, for example, as the XC93 that I measured last week, but it is pretty accurate. And given that the LG CMSs don't work, that's really a moot point anyway between those two TVs. So picture-wise, with SDR content, it looked absolutely stunning. The level of detail in there was superb. The color accuracy was great. You can get a really accurate grayscale with calibration. It wasn't perfect out of the box, but it was pretty good. And the motion handling was great too, which is always something that Sony do really well. So I thought it looked great. With HDR content, it's the usual problem with OLED. You don't get those really impactful peak highlights you would get with an LCD TV, but you get greater precision because obviously it's at a pixel level. You know, it has the sort of the pluses and the minuses of an OLED TV. In terms of support, it supports HDR10 out of the box. And as with Sony's other TVs that use the X1 Extreme processor, they will be adding Hybrid Log Gamma and Dolby Vision later in the year. And it currently has Android M, Android 6.10 or 0.1, I think it is. But that will be, again, upgraded to Android N, Android 7 in later in the year as well. I think the plan is they're going to do all this in one go, although when exactly remains to be seen. So the question becomes, you know, given there are a number of different OLEDs available this year on the marketplace, why would you go for the A1? And that's a very valid question, because you are paying for a lot of things you might not necessarily use. You're particularly paying, obviously, for the design and the build and the acoustical surface. $5,000 is a lot of money for, I mean, even, sorry, just go for the 55-inch, $3,300 is still toppy. You can get an LG OLED, like the B7 or the C7, for less than that, and it's going to be using the same panel. And it's going to include Dolby Vision, and it's going to include HLG and all those other things. So the question becomes, are you looking for the design and the acoustical surface, or are you just looking for an OLED TV and specifically the panel itself? In which case, it's the same kind of quandary that would have faced people who are thinking of buying, do you buy the E6 or the G6 last year from LG when they were the same television, but you were basically paying for the bling.
They're not the same TV though, because you've got Sony's processing on it.
Yeah, it's a valid question, Phil. I think it depends on how much emphasis and importance you place upon Sony's processing compared to other manufacturers. It is very good, no question about that. And also whether you value things like the acoustical surface and the design and that sort of stuff, as to whether it's something you would choose over, say, an LG or Panasonic or Philips, all of whom have models out this year in terms of OLEDs. I liked it a lot. I do like it a lot. I just found certain aspects of design really annoying, personally.
Yeah, but you see, other people are going to find that to their favour, to be honest. So I guess you've got to give Sony kudos here, because they've actually taken a brave decision, A, to move into OLED, but B, to go the way that they have in terms of the design aspect, in terms of using the no speaker approach and using the panel as a speaker and that kind of thing. I mean, you got to applaud that, because for a long time, Sony have just done the bare minimum to make the TV department try and make some money. So them actually taking that step out, I've got to applaud them. I know what you're saying in terms of choice for the consumer and all the rest of it, but just looking at it from a point of view of Sony getting their mojo back, it certainly points to that.
Yeah, no question about it. I think we've talked about this before on the podcast, that there's a bit of swagger to Sony this year, and the A1 is definitely the prime example of that sort of ambition. Because, like I say, I mean, there's stuff in this TV that you won't see on any other TV. It does make it stand out from the crowd, and in what is a slightly crowded OLED market this year, I think that might be an important factor for them.
Of course,
I have to say, someone perhaps less absorbed in the minutiae of spec, I'm not in a position to buy any of these televisions, but I do feel that design does justify a price premium. I think it's a clever solution to how to make a screen look elegant whilst, you know, not putting speakers with the sort of vocal range of a child's talking doll on the side of it. And yes, if you try and do things that are bold, it doesn't always work perfectly. And, you know, if you are a midget like Steve, it's clearly going to be a problem to plug it all up. Equally, very clear, there is an element, I need to be very clear about this, because I'm just as guilty of it. There is an element of reviewer sort of emphasis here. Most people do not have televisions come in and go out on quite the best, or product full stop. So, you know, on occasions, for example, with the KEF R500 review I did recently, I got a bit of a hump on because they are an absolute pain in the ass to box and unbox. But for most people, buying a pair of loudspeakers, they're only going to do that once, is sort of no concern to them. Same in so many ways. So it goes probably with the bulk of connections on these televisions. Yes, you're going to have an afternoon of inconvenience, but then it's going to be fit and forget after that. You shouldn't get too het up about it.
Yeah, very much so. And you've got to look at it and say, well, have Sony learnt a lesson here? Because if you think back to the TVs, Steve, where they had the huge speakers on the sides and they were massive, to now having no speaker whatsoever. And it really is an interesting solution. I mean, you said it sounded okay, but I'm assuming that's at normal volumes. Did you try and push it at all?
Yeah, you can push it, and it sounds. I actually think for a built-in sound system on a TV, it sounds really good. I was watching Moana, which is essentially a musical, and this TV handled it really well. I mean, obviously, you're not going to be getting the surround experience you would get from some sort of outboard audio solution.
But I was thinking more of distortion and that kind of thing, Steve.
Yeah, no, it doesn't. No, you can put it out pretty loud. Like I said, I moved it out really loudly, put it out really high in order to see whether I could see the screen vibrating, and couldn't. And yeah, it didn't distort or anything. It does work really well. It's an impressive piece of technology, I have to say. And it sounded really good for a built-in TV sound. I'd say it's probably the best sounding TV I've heard in a very long time. Certainly probably since the days of Sony's massive side speakers, in fact. And like you say, Phil, obviously you have the minimalist beauty of just looking at a screen. It's really clever. It's really clever, and it does set them apart. The one area I've got a bone to pick with Sony about this, and it's not just on this TV. This applies to all their TVs, and it's a bizarre decision on their part. There are four HDMI inputs, but only two of them support 4K at up to 60p. The other two are limited to 30p. They all support HDR10. They all support HDCP 2.2, but only two go up to 4K 60p, which seems like a strange decision to make. It's sort of limiting your HDMI inputs on what is, an expensive and flagship TV. Same thing on the XD93, which I reviewed last week. I don't know why they're doing that. It doesn't make any sense. All the other manufacturers just have this, the same full fat HDMI inputs on all their TVs. It's a bizarre decision on the part of Sony. One I can't understand. I can see no logical cost reason for doing it. Really, when you're talking about a TV at this price, the differences in costs are going to be insignificant. It's weird, but yeah, striking design, excellent performance, great sound. So. Yeah, it's certainly going to be. The only issue, obviously, is it's not cheap, but it'll be interesting to see how it competes against the flagships from Panasonic and LG this year.
Well, obviously, the LG flagship is exceedingly more expensive.
You're talking about
the W. Yeah, it's excessively more expensive than this. But again, I mean, this points to something that I'm really happy to see, because for a long time, they've just been rectangle shapes basically on a stand of various design. It's nice to see a little bit of design, a little bit of industrial design, a little bit of thinking about how they're going to do things a little bit differently, like the W7, like the A1. Rather than just having a box or a rectangular shape, it's nice that they're trying to make these differences. But anyway, we've run out of time for hardware stuff. We're going to really have to make a move on, because we were talking about general elections, you see. So it's movie news next. Okay, so moving on, movie news, and it's clear to see how Odeon make money out of their unlimited card.
Why they make money out of you, anyway?
Well, you see, if I'm typical of people who think, oh yeah, that's a great idea, and splash out and then never go, then obviously they're making money. They're making money on it to run the thing. So there you go. I haven't been this month yet. And there's not really a lot that interests me. I mean, Fast and Furious 8. Who wants to watch that, Gubbins?
Fast and Furious 8. Right, let's get a few things out of the way, first of all. Biggest worldwide opening of any film history.
That just says to me that there's a lot of stupid people out there.
Honestly, it beat The Force Awakens, the biggest worldwide opening in cinema history. Staggering, made over half $1 billion in its opening weekend for the eighth film in a crappy series about people driving sports cars. Incredible. All I can say is, having seen the film at the cinema, and unlike you, Phil, I've actually managed to use my card. I went back to my previous bookings. I've used it twice a month for all through this year. So I am just above breaking even, actually. So it's all good. Saw it at the cinema.
But you've got to go to a crap cinema, though. At least mine's is
well,
like
not for much longer. it's utterly ridiculous. But at the same time, it is ridiculously entertaining.
So could it be safe to say that Jurassic World and the Fast and the Furious films have kept Universal afloat over the last couple of years?
Big time. Yeah, big time. the Fast and the Furious films, like I say, they just break all the rules. And they get better as they go on. And
I question that. I think with hindsight, 5 will remain an extraordinary peak, an utterly unexpected confluence of various things combining to make something ridiculously brilliant. And then after that, they've completely changed the outlook of what they do, and it's quite marketable and it's working all right. But I don't think they're getting better.
Well, okay, yes, you're right. I think Fast 5 still is the peak of the franchise to date. However, Fast and the Furious 8, or The Fate of the Furious, depending on where you live, I'd say is the best one since Fast 5. I think it is really, really fun. I mean, it is ridiculous, so ridiculous that I actually was laughing out loud at various points at how ludicrous what was happening on screen was. But I was also thoroughly enjoying it. And, you know, they've got such an amazing... You've got Jason Statham coming back, you've got Helen Mirren popping up, you've got Kurt Russell in there. You know, it's got a fantastic cast. Charlize Theron's quite good as the villain, a genuine threat. And the stunts and everything else, and the effects are all top draw. It was brilliant fun. It was 2 hours of pure escapist entertainment. And I tell you what, in the current times, you know, going to the cinema last week, I had Trump rattling his saber at North Korea threatening to nuke the world. You know, I could do with it getting away from all this nonsense at the moment. And this was the perfect antidote. And I thoroughly enjoyed it. So if you haven't seen it yet and you're a fan of this, I mean, Ed, really, I know you don't want to go to the cinema, but definitely get the disc because you
will. Oh, I will get, don't worry, I'll get the disc, but the cinema, it's full of people and, you know, it's just horrible. I'm afraid, slowly but surely turning into Howard Hughes, but without the money.
I've got to say it.
But with the bottles of urine.
Well, I'm working on that.
I've got to say, in my defence, the last 2 weeks have been Easter break, and there's no way I'm going anywhere near the Metro Centre Easter break, so... You know, there are reasons as to why I haven't gone to the cinema on my usual days.
I think go next week, though.
I'm definitely going to go next week. Why am I going next week, Steve?
Because next week, or rather at the end of
this
week...
I am Groot.
Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2 comes out. And I've got to say, I personally, this is my second film of April. I've already bought my ticket booked. I'm at the midnight screening on Thursday night before it opens.
I'm not that desperate.
No, all right. Yeah. But I loved the first film. I thought it was really, really good. I thought it was a complete out, because I knew nothing about the Guardians of the Galaxy from the comics. I don't suppose most people did. But it was so much fun. It really captured that kind of escapist space adventure spirit that I hadn't really experienced since, I guess, the early days of Star Wars. And so I'm really looking forward to this. The early word on it from the reviews that have been done from pre-screenings last week were that it's as much fun, but also quite emotional and moving in places. So I really think they've upped their game on this one. I think James Gunn did a brilliant job last time. He's the same writer-director this time around. He's being hired to do it again for the third one. Obviously, they're tailoring this film now to fit in with the whole Marvel universe, because they're leading towards the Infinity War, which is next year. But yeah, I'm really looking forward to this. It's got a great cast. Again, Kurt Russell is in this one, and Sylvester Stallone, along with everybody else. And I can't wait to see this.
Yeah, I might pop along. I'll have to put something on my card this month. At least I can go and have a Five Guys while I'm there.
Well, it sounds like you've got it all down pat. I think my wife is going to venture out and see it. She did quite enjoy the first one.
The first one, complete surprise to me. I have no interest in the Marvel Universe, as you all know, but thoroughly loved and enjoyed the Guardians of the Galaxy.
Guardians of the Galaxy.
They actually do that joke in the film, too.
Do they? All right.
Yes. You've made it, Phil.
Yeah. Well, they used our Rouge One joke at Star Wars Convention last week.
Yeah. Excellent. That's all good. No, I mean, as I say, I wasn't planning on going to the cinema ever.
Ever.
We'll see what happens.
Yeah. You know. I was going to say, you know, if there was a, some sort of viral outbreak and everybody else died, you'd survive, but actually you wouldn't because you got a three-year-old. You'd be one of the first ones gone.
No, well, except that I'm actually now I have over the space of having him, and then obviously a procession of people come through the house for music lessons. I have, over the last 5 years, I think already been exposed to pretty much every pathogen known to man. So I'll take my chances.
So you survived the viral outbreak, but you died because of a lack of gout medicine. So
this is the thing. This is actually one of the most depressing things about going on to a lifetime, because it's like, well, actually, I am no longer going to rule the apocalyptic wastelands. I'm just going to probably sit there with a really sore foot going, oh, so, it's the nature of things, isn't it?
Well, there's our quote for this week's podcast.
I mean, to be honest, it's as much, we're in this, television is slowly picking up again. The only time I could go out would be if, you know, I negotiated with my wife, she stayed in for the evening and I went out to the cinema, and there's lots of things on, you know, MasterChef, we've basically completed the opening round. It's time for competition to get serious. I mean, in some ways I enjoy that. Also, I always miss when we've run out of delusional people, but you know, that's all good. Plenty of other things to watch as well. So we'll see how we go. It's just, you know, cinema's a long way away and it's got people in it.
Yeah, we were discussing the other day as well, me saying that I'm, under or minus or whatever, it's kind of irrelevant when you're driving a Mustang 12 miles in, 12 miles back.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Rogue One, the Blu-ray. We mentioned it last week, and none of us had gone around to watching it apart from Steve. That's because Steve hasn't got anything else better to do. But anyway, I managed to catch up with it last Thursday night, and I've watched it two times since then. I did read the thread on the forums, and I'm not having to go at any members or anything like that, but there was a lot of comments like the bass was terrible and there wasn't enough of this and the soundtrack wasn't great and all this. I don't know what you guys are listening on. Maybe you need to get your systems looked at, because that is one hell of a sounding soundtrack. It is superb, and I'm really lost for words. I don't know what people are mentioning when they say the soundtrack wasn't all that. Picture quality and sound quality on that disc was absolutely stunning.
Yeah, I totally agree. In fact, I got a bit carried away at the weekend because of Star Wars Celebration, and ended up watching it in 3D, and then I watched The Force Awakens in 3D as well, both. And then the 3D actually was better than I was remembered from the cinema and was expecting. The first half of the film, because quite a lot of the film is in very dark scenes, particularly the Edu sequence, which is very dark, doesn't lend itself well to 3D. But the second half of the movie, when obviously on their brightly lit beaches and Scarif and their space battles and stuff, looked awesome in 3D, actually. Like you say, Phil, sound is superb. I think it's a great disc. I really don't understand some of the criticism. People are saying that the picture quality improves as the film goes on. I think that's more a question of the early sequences are shot on Iceland.
And the
location shoots, and it's supposed to be quite dull. Well,
the dream sequences, because it's her remembering what happened. So that's kind of, they're supposed to be a little bit soft and a little bit dream sequency.
Yeah,
that's how they're graded. That's how it's supposed to look. That's how it looked in the cinema when I went to see it three times.
It's exactly. Yeah, I've seen it three times at the cinema, including an IMAX 3D presentation. I know what it's supposed to look like, and the disc replicates that, to the full limit of Blu-ray's capabilities.
I do think some of it is trolling. There's no doubt about that. Whether it's done for, you know, somebody's bored or the one that pushed the conversation along or whatever. But in other ways, I think it does point to setting up systems in different rooms, personal preferences in terms of how they run, I think, and how people run their subwoofers. I think a lot of people run very hot. Let's face it, not everybody can properly set up a sound system in a living room like we have in our, we're lucky enough to have dedicated rooms, Steve, and be able to have, the speakers at the right height all the way around and the right distances and all the rest of it. Whereas in a living room, sometimes you don't get away with that. But I am surprised that, and maybe people's just have high expectations these days, or expect things, because there's been so many great soundtracks out there, they expect certain things within a scene to make noises that don't. Or
I think that's a big factor in it, Phil, actually. You're absolutely right. We obviously are in a lucky position that we have these, really high quality systems set up and dedicated rooms, and obviously that helps. But people said similar things about the Force Awakens soundtrack as well. Again, another, in my opinion, amazing soundtrack. I think there's a certain expectation these days for over the top bombastic soundtracks with tons of subwoofer and tons of bass and loads of aggressive effects, and what actually Rogue One and The Force Awakens have are really well mixed, beautifully designed, immersive, subtle soundtracks that deliver the bass when they need to, and also deliver stereo effects the way they're meant to, you know, and are carefully layered. And, you know, I think people probably sometimes don't quite appreciate the amount of work that's gone into something. I mean, having spoken to Matthew Wood, the guy did, yeah, did the supervised sound editor on The Force Awakens and on Rogue One, you know, I know from what he was saying that the level of detail and thought that goes into these sound designs, and for me, that I think they're amazing, but perhaps people just have different expectations these days in terms of what a soundtrack should sound like.
You've got, you know, the soundtrack, you've got effects and explosions and everything else, you've got dialogue, and you've also got atmosphere effects like wind and all the rest of it. If you were to go over the top with it, it just becomes a noise, becomes a mess, and it pulls you out of the film. And the thing about a soundtrack, the thing about visual effects and all the rest of it is, it's there to immerse you into that film. It's not there to stand out and say, oh, did you hear that effect over here, and did you hear this up here above your head and all the rest of it. That's not the point whatsoever. Yeah. So I think expectations are a little bit high. I think the way people set their systems up are maybe not ideal for everything. And there's lots to learn on the forums, you know. It's one of the things that we were discussing about back in 2000 when AV Forums launched, and still talking about now in 2017, you know, what is the correct position for these speakers? What's the best thing for my room or your room, and so on. So that certainly highlighted it, because I went into Rogue One thinking, oh, well, this is not going to be great. And it was absolutely stunning. And it was stunning at the cinema as well. So
I still haven't watched it.
Come on, Ed, pull your finger out.
But yeah, unfortunately, you kind of watch it on a turntable, or that's an unfortunate thing.
In other news, I'm Danny Dyer, and I'm about to meet Britain's most sexually frustrated fisherman.
That could be a believable episode, actually. Blu-ray releases this week, Steve.
Yeah, not a massive week this week for new releases. Some fairly, I guess, the catalogue or not-so-well-known title. We've got The Void, which is a new horror film. Kaz has reviewed that, and actually thinks it's really good, actually. He gave it 8 out of 10. So said it was an interesting take on the horror genre, more of a very John Carpenter-esque feel to it, an 80s throwback, which I've got to say does sound quite interesting. There'll be a lot of practical effects in there too, which again appeals to me. So that's out this week. It's called The Void. And if you're interested with 80s horror, practical effects could be up your street. We've also got Drunken Master, which is a Masters of Cinema reissue. Jackie Chan's big breakthrough movie, basically. So kung fu and comedy mixed together. If you're a Jackie Chan fan or an Asian cinema fan or a kung fu movie fan, could be one for you. And finally, we've got Hard Times, which is, again, another, I think it's Eureka reissue of Walter Hill's first movie. So Walter Hill, who made Streets of Fire and The Long Riders, among many others, and also co-wrote and produced the original Alien. He is his first movie, stars Charles Bronson and James Coburn, and is about street fighters in 20s America, I believe. So that's out as well. So like I say, not some big A-list titles this week. I guess Rogue One kind of stole all the thunder last week, and this week we got some lesser titles out.
Okay, and what crap can we buy on UHD Blu-ray?
Actually, quite quiet on the UHD Blu-ray front. Nothing major has been announced recently. I mean, there's stuff coming out. So this week, stuff coming out over the next couple of weeks that's, of interest to certain people, mainly me, I think. you got Assassin's Creed coming soon. We got La La Land coming out next week in the States. Not in the UK for a bit longer. But I think in the UK it's in a couple of weeks' time. But in the States it's out next week. And that's one I'm definitely looking forward to. I've seen some early reviews of that say it looks and sounds amazing. Dolby Atmos soundtrack, of course.
Yeah, I'm disappointed I missed that one at the cinema. I would like to have seen that on the big screen. Just to have seen it too.
And also, interestingly, 2.55 to 1 aspect ratio, Phil. So very wide screen.
All right, okay.
But yeah, that's coming out next week in the States and in the UK in 2 weeks' time after that. And it's definitely one I'm looking forward to, personally.
Okay, so I suppose we better do some Star Wars news. It was just unfortunate that last week we recorded the podcast before the Easter break, and celebration really sort of kicked off. And I've got to say, I've never been one in the past to sit and watch any of the streams, but I did also watch the 40th anniversary panel the day before, Steve, and I've got to say, lots and lots and lots of surprises on that one. They kept them secret,
didn't they?
Yeah.
They announced a couple of names, but not the big ones.
Yeah. So, I mean, you had George Lucas there, who looked lost, bless him. I think a lot of that was the stress of trying to remember which story it was he was going to tell this week about how Star Wars came about and all the rest of it. He's trying to remember what canon he's on this week in terms of, but he did look lost. He looked lost amongst.
He looked like what have I done? Yeah. What have I created? You're looking at these massive people in front of him.
Yeah, but I mean, the thing with that is that it wouldn't have been a 40th anniversary, you know, panel without him having been there.
Yeah, he had to be there.
And then you had the usual people who are normally there at the conventions, but then the next big surprise was obviously Harrison Ford. That's the first time he has ever been to a Star Wars celebration, and the reaction he got was great, and I thought the humour about where he landed his plane and stuff was excellent. And even George Lucas had a joke on that one. And then you had the Carrie Fisher tribute, which was fantastic. Yeah, the 4-minute video that is on YouTube, go watch it, is absolutely brilliant. And then they opened the curtain at the side of the screen after that, and John Williams is standing there, and you got a bit of a mini...
I'd love it. Did he just stab out his cigarette in a hurry? Bollocks, yeah.
Almost like that. But no, they just kept rolling the surprises in, didn't they? And it was really well done for the 40th. If you're a fan of the original films and stuff, there was some really good content in there. It's all still online. It's on the StarWars.com YouTube channel, so go and have a look at it. You're going to have to sit through the whole thing, but it is really, really good. And then the Last Jedi, we got to know quite a bit about that. And then we got the trailer, which I've watched it a few times now, and it doesn't give anything away, I don't think. And
you can also, if it's Rogue One, is anything to go by. Very little of that will actually be in the
film. I was just going to say that exact thing. I was going to say they've probably learnt the lesson with Rogue One, and none of that is probably in there. But I guess the line that's got everybody going, Steve, is Luke's line at the end, which is it's time for the Jedi to end, which is an absolute, and we all know what happens with an absolute and where that comes from.
Yeah, clearly. And I don't really blame him for being slightly disenchanted with the Jedi, because, frankly, over the course of 6 films, they've been rubbish, haven't they? Not anything. But, I mean, there were some early hints of that when Daisy Ridley came on, because she was talking about Rey meeting Luke, her hero, and finding out that your heroes aren't necessarily what you think they're going to be, which suggests that Luke's a very ambiguous, greyer character in this film, someone who's perhaps...
Interesting use of the word grey.
Not necessarily dark or light, perhaps somewhere in the middle who's you know, lost his faith a little bit, maybe in the Force and the Jedi. So I think that's an interesting take on the character. I can see that being interesting. I know Rian Johnson, who wrote and directed Episode 8, is a very different filmmaker to J.J. Abrams. He's a much more, no offense to J.J. Abrams, he's a more original filmmaker. I think he will take more chances. I think this will be a very different film to The Force Awakens. I think it'll be much less of a... I mean, I see what they were doing with The Force Awakens. We've said this before. Abrams had a massive task on his hands. He had to justify a $4 billion investment. He had to deliver a film that's going to make money. He had to tie it in with the previous films, but also make it something new or reboot it for a new generation. I think The Force Awakens did all those things brilliantly, but it was a bit similar to Star Wars. I think with The Last Jedi, we're going to get something very different. I certainly hope
we do. I've got to say, The Force Awakens does not stand up to repeated viewing.
I actually don't really enjoy it when I watch it the weekend.
Yeah, but I find it's not a classic.
It's a greatest hits album.
Yeah, exactly, that's what it is, yeah.
Gets by mostly on some very, very charming leads. And by that I mean Daisy and John Boyega, I think, and also Oscar Isaacs. I think they really carry the film. Nice having Harrison Ford back as well for a bit, but they are charming. And I think the fact that we like those characters and those actors means that will really help the Last Jedi, because they're obviously going to be in it in a major way this time. And it'll also be nice, hopefully, this time to give some lines to Mark Hamill. So, it did what it was meant to do, right? It teased me. I got my interest. I'm looking forward to December and seeing where the story goes. And hopefully getting some answers, because one of the big problems I have with The Force Awakens is lots of questions and hardly any answers in the film. So maybe we'll find out a bit more about Rey's parentage and history. Obviously a bit more about the First Order, a bit more about Supreme Leader Snoke and where he comes from, what's his you know, ultimate end game. And more, hopefully, it looks like from the teaser, we'll find out more about why Kylo Ren turned, what happened between him and Luke. So yeah, it, job done. It teased me and got my interest.
Only 6 more months of this, listeners.
6 more months of this, and then almost immediately we'll be straight into 6 more months leading up to the Han Solo movie next May.
Can we start doing these in the evening again, so I can
so you can get drunk?
Yeah. Guys, we're at nearly 90 minutes and I'm losing the will to live. All right? I'd like to go.
Have you looked at the running order, Ed? Because you're not going to like what's next.
We're at 90 minutes. We ain't doing that. It's as simple as that. There is an hour's worth of passable content here.
I don't know if you saw this, Phil. Obviously, they streamed certain things from the celebration, but some stuff wasn't streamed. Really annoyingly, like the best stuff wasn't streamed. So there was a whole presentation by John Knoll about the effects in Rogue One. And some people videoed it from their phones. And there was a whole sequence they showed, like a single take from Star Wars, of the scene when they're talking around the table about the Death Star and that would be a useless gesture. They had that whole single take. And there's that little bit snippets in there that aren't in the film that were really interesting about, you know, sending out this Sith Lord could be trouble for all of us and this kind of thing. Worth checking out if you see it on YouTube.
I've already seen it.
Oh, right. Okay, there you go.
I'm a Star Wars geek, Steve. I think we better go. I could hear the knife drawer opening there in Ed's house, and I really don't want him to do anything.
Yeah.
Everyone laughing when Darth Vader delivered his dialogue in Dave Prowse's Bristol accent.
No.
That was quite funny.
Oh no, that's a can of beer being opened. I think we better end it there. And on that bombshell, that's it for the eForums podcast this week. Many thanks to Steve Withers.
Just forget you ever saw it. Better that way.
And Ed Selly's going to give us a Danny Dyer line.
Oh shit. I'm Danny Dyer and I'm about to meet Britain's most spherical geese.
Don't forget, you can follow us on Twitter and Facebook, bookmark avforums.com for latest reviews, news and videos, and of course leave us those 5-star ratings on iTunes, but only if you enjoyed the show. I'm Phil Hinton, thank you very much for listening, and we'll see you again next week.